All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. It's Friday again. Isn't that funny? The way that keeps happening. It's a different Friday every time, but it's also Friday again. Well, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I appreciate y'all tuning in today. I did finally get a hold of Antonio Bueller yesterday, right as soon as it was too late to interview him. But I got him on today, so that should be good. He's the libertarian anti-police activist who was acquitted in one of them so-called courts of law the other day, somehow. So that should be good. And, I don't know. I got a bunch of invites out, so maybe we'll hear back. Ray McGovern was not just arrested, but was brutally manhandled by the pigs yesterday. He already has a shoulder injury. And there are multiple witnesses from his arrest and from the actual police station where they booked him, talking about him crying out in pain about his shoulder. And he's out of jail this morning. I spoke briefly with Deborah Sweet from World Can't Wait, and she's with him there now, and when I talked to her, he was on the phone with his lawyer. But Ray, of course, is always very generous with his time, so if it's at all possible, I'm sure he will do the show today and tell us what the hell happened there. The great Ray McGovern. He went to protest John Nagel and David Petraeus. Maybe point out how the sainted general is the most celebrated loser of two wars in world history. Or maybe Ray was just going to complain, about the killing in specific, or I don't know. Anyway, never got the chance. Bought his ticket and everything. You can read all about it at Fire Dog Lake. Kevin Gotstola has a write-up at Fire Dog Lake, and then I believe it should be in the top headlines. I sent it to Eric. Yeah, it's at the bottom of the top headlines at antiwar.com right now. Ray McGovern arrested trying to attend New York Petraeus event. That David Petraeus, he's only ever accomplished one mission in his whole life, and that was raping the brain holes of every media flunky in Washington, D.C. and New York City. They can't think of anything he ever failed at. Iraq. Afghanistan. They can't think of that. No. Oh, wow. You sure do have a shiny chest full of medals there, David Petraeus. The heroic battle of the desk that you sat at. But boy, does he have some great PR guys. And boy, does he have some great security to keep people who might contradict that narrative from showing up where he's speaking. John Nagel. I would love to take on John Nagel and David Petraeus at the same time. John Nagel, who went from being the head cheerleader for doubling and tripling down the Afghan war, extending it, killing tens of thousands of more people in order to give the Afghan people a government in a box to change their entire society, he said. To change their entire society. We're going to have a counterinsurgency surge for a couple of years. It didn't even accomplish its most basic goal, beating the Taliban so bloody they'd come to the table and America could negotiate our exit and theirs from life in Afghanistan. And nope, that didn't work either. He went to become the principal of some boys' academy upstate somewhere in disgrace. Now I guess somehow it's been a couple of years enough that he can go out and speak. They said he wrote a new book about his time fighting in the first Gulf War. What do you mean, John Nagel, that your book isn't about your great victory in Afghanistan, you pathetic loser, blood-soaked murderer? pathetic loser. You wrote a book about a tank battle in 1991, you pathetic disgrace. How about your great victory over the Taliban in Afghanistan? Where's your book about that? Ray McGovern tries to get a ticket to this collection of American heroes and is brutally arrested on charges of disturbing the peace and this, that, the other thing. According to this report by Kevin Gostela, all of the protesters who were also with McGovern, they were all called by their first names by the security goons. Now, you might think, okay, they know Ray McGovern, as we spoke with Peter Van Buren about his persecution at the hands of the State Department. And they put him on a be on the lookout and whatever, as though he was some kind of threat to Hillary Clinton, since he had once turned his back on her. Anyway, so they said, nope, you can't come in, Ray. But then they also called everybody else, Mike, Joe, Dave, and Susie, too. What? What's that about? What all intel did they have on the peace activists who were attempting to show up that night? They're just watching Twitter feeds, or they're doing worse than that, I wonder. Anyway, we'll see what I can do about getting Ray McGovern on. I just called and it rang and rang, and I thought, you know what? I bet I'm screwing up an interview with somebody else right now. I better cool it. Anyway. the great Ray McGovern, former CIA officer, now good person. Peace activist. Brutally arrested by the NYPD last night. Out of jail this morning, but injured. And in fact, you know, I don't know. If it could be that he's got to go to the hospital over what they did to his shoulder. Ray McGovern, 72 years old. In case you're not familiar, 72, 73 years old. Cancer survivor. In any other circumstance, he would be former CIA officer Ray McGovern, whose every word must be taken as gospel, except for who he is and what it is he says. But boy, if he was a warmonger, would he be on top of a giant pedestal right now? McGovern, who was 74 years old, told the guards something to the effect of the Bill of Rights gave him the right to go into the event. He had a ticket. The guards would not let him pass, and soon New York police officers surrounded him. Richard Marini, also an activist with World Can't Wait, approached the entrance to the 92nd Street Y Center and saw McGovern, who was 74, being apprehended. Little redundancy in the quick edit here. According to Marini, his arms were twisted tightly behind his back, and he was in immense pain while they were dragging him to the police car. He was squeezed in the back of the patrol car and taken to the 67th Street station. Rugoff heard him screaming, that is, McGovern. He was shouting about how they were hurting his shoulder. He asked the officers to stop twisting it so they did not aggravate his shoulder and possibly re-injure it. I had a ticket as well, Marini explained. They recognized me and called me by my name, my first name. They seemed to know who people were. Yeah. Well, there's your counterinsurgency doctrine. Finally achieved something there, David Petraeus, pathetic loser. I think that is kind of cool, though, how his name, Petraeus, will go down in history as a kind of synonym for general who's good at PR but actually never did anything except get his men killed for nothing. You know, and innocent civilians, too. That's what his son's name, his grandson's name will mean, too. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And it's libertarian foreign policy mostly, but, you know, I can talk about other stuff. The cops. All right. All right, so here's just a fun thing. In Burkina Faso, a pseudo-dictator has been overthrown. And I don't know if the whole state has been overthrown with him. I think the way I read it, the military was perhaps too late, trying to side with the people against the government. The dictator, pseudo-elected dictator, but what have you, whatever. Blaise Compaoré. I admit, I don't know a damn thing about him or the government of Burkina Faso. But I did think it was great to see a bunch of people burn down the parliament building. You know, I saw a poll on Fox News where, I mean, it was on Fox News. I don't know if it was true or not, but it was, I'm trying to download straight from the Pentagon into my brain and know exactly what they would have me think the worst of times, you know. And they had a poll that Americans would like to see the entire House of Representatives replaced. Not a single incumbent reelected and just start over. Well, hey guys, is it really that hard to imagine just not having a Congress? Why do we need a national government anyway? Can't we be the USA under the Articles of Confederation? We don't need them. We don't need them at all. I know they say we need them. No doubt about that. They are convinced. The U.S. national government. But what do you need them for? So you can get your son killed? In one of these stupid wars? We gotta have a Congress. It just shouldn't be any of the people who've been currently elected to that position. But yeah, but the system itself is great, but it's just doesn't seem to be working out right, but it's still, it's awesome. In Burkina Faso, they decided, hey, let's burn down the capital. That'll prevent them from calling a quorum. And, you know, I don't know who's going to come next. I don't know who did the deed. Was it the people? Was it a particular faction wants power for themselves? Seemed like a pretty popular thing. Who's going to come out on top? I don't know. I just like seeing a government destroyed. I remember a few years back, the headline was, Canadian government falls. And libertarians everywhere went, yes, wait, really? And of course, all they meant was the current administration, the prime ministership, had fallen into no confidence and they were going to hold some new elections. And the government of Canada wasn't going nowhere. Not its agencies, not the employees, not their public employee unions. Nah, they just replaced one guy with another guy who, I guess the current guy, further to the right. It was such a great headline, though. Canadian government falls. Right now, they're actually free for a minute. No. All right. No, so that's my good news of the day. Sorry, I don't know anything about it other than they successfully overthrew their president. He announced he was going to run for a fifth term after 27 years, and they said, no, you're not. And, I don't know. The pictures seem to depict regular folk in the street making this happen and having a good time. Could have been a CIA thing. Probably not. Don't know what's going to happen. But anyway. And where the hell is Burkina Faso? It's in West Africa. That's where it is. I know, you got me. It could have been in the East Indies or something for all I know. I mean, I don't know. I guess I knew it was in Africa somewhere, but I didn't know where. I might have guessed further south. All right, well, whatever. I guess I'll go ahead and get to the bad news now. I got a few minutes. Back to it in the next segment. Chuck Hagel, the current Secretary of Defense. I'm not sure. There's an article in the New York Times about how there may be a big cabinet reshuffle coming, and it may include Hagel. And this may be why. I don't know. But he's moving hard to cover his ass right now. The Secretary of Defense, former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel, has castigated the U.S. strategy in Syria in a memo to the White House, saying Washington must explain its intentions toward President Bashar al-Assad's regime. And now, so obviously there's the politics of this here, but then that's not what's important to me. What's important to me is, what is he getting at? What is he saying the policy should be? And I'm thinking here, he doesn't say. He's saying, Mr. President, you must decide what exactly your Syria policy is, and then make your intentions plain, and then this and that. Is he not recommending a policy? What are you saying? You want to carpet bomb Damascus and force the Baathists out of power? Or you're saying it's time to back Assad and the Baathists against the Sunni-based insurgency and their Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-ish allies? Or are you really saying build up some moderate force of moderate Sunni jihadists to somehow fight Assad, etc.? Assad, Hezbollah, and their enemies in Nusra and ISIS? Nobody really believes that. That's stupid. I don't know. It doesn't, this article, that I have here about, Hagel's memo, it doesn't really say. Here's the only thing it says about the controversy over what the policy should be. Some U.S. lawmakers, analysts, retired military officers, and Syrian opposition activists have heaped criticism on Obama's approach to Syria, accusing the administration of bolstering Assad's position by striking at the Islamic State without confronting the regime. Really? Same as always. That's your opposition. You're not doing enough to fight the Islamic State's enemies at the same time you're fighting the Islamic State. That's the complaint. The complaint of who? Congressmen, analysts, meaning well-funded DC think tanks, retired military officers, meaning board members of military industrial complex firms, and Syrian opposition activists, which means Syrian opposition activists. Is there no one anti-war, to be quoted? Is there no one who's been saying for any part of the last 3 years that it has been an insane policy to back the rebellion against Assad, and that's what's led us to this at all? No? I mean, I wouldn't expect him to name me, but I can think of some people that they could quote, but no. Is that Hagel's position, that we ought to continue seeking regime change against Assad? Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show.
Oops.
I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm live here from noon to 3, have been, here on LRN weekdays here. That's Eastern time. But starting Monday, I'm cutting it back to noon to 2. I got too many other things to do. And it really sucks because what I would really like to do is add another hour and do a 4-hour show every day and do more calls and do more news. But I just don't have the time. I tried to switch with Ernie Hancock, who's got the early morning show, but he needs the early morning show for the same reason I do. More time to do other things. So, no dice. It was worth a shot, but no. So, anyway, I'm cutting back the show. I'm still going to do everything I can to try, and it doesn't always work out like today, you can tell. But I am going to continue trying to interview 3 people a day every day if I can. I'll still have time to do that. I'll have 1 segment to rant and rave and then 3 interviews if I can time everything well. So, I don't know. As you may know, I've got an obligation to write a book with Tom Woods. And all I've done is write the outline. I know how I want it to be and what I want it to be and all that. But it's going to take putting in the hours. And I still have a ton of responsibilities for antiwar.com and all kinds of other stuff. And so I got to do it. So that's starting on Monday. Cutting the show back to 2 hours. It'll be noon to 2. Live here noon to 2 weekdays on the Liberty Radio Network. That should be all right. I'm still on KPFK. You might have tried to hear me on KPFK the last few weeks, and you might have wondered, hey, what happened to Scott Horton on KPFK? Well, it's their fund drive. And once their fund drive, they just take that time to raise money. So, but this week I'll be back, and then I'm trying to get a time change there. They got me, I used to have awesome Friday nights there on KPFK, and then, well, it was easier to keep that spot when I lived in LA. Now that I'm here in Austin again, last year or so, I guess they moved me to Sunday morning, early Sunday morning, which that is actually typically, a pretty good time for them for public affairs stuff. It's sort of like the Sunday morning news shows. It's not all just, you know, and every other radio station is playing gardening shows and crap. They actually have pretty good listenership on Sunday morning. But if I can't have Friday night, I still want some weekday afternoon spot on KPFK so that it's just easier for my schedule than having to record an interview on Saturday to play on Sunday and all that. Anyway, maybe I'm telling you more than you care about at all, but that's how it is. I will have an interview with somebody, even if I just gotta, you know, take a best of from this week. I will have something to play on KPFK on Sunday there, 90.7 FM in LA. And then it's rebroadcast. It's a great spot to have even on Sunday morning, man. It's rebroadcast in San Diego and in the Inland Empire, in Santa Barbara, and all over Southern California, man. I mean, damn near the Arizona border and way the hell out there at sea. I don't know how far out to sea it really goes, but pretty damn far, I'm under the impression. And all the way up the coast, because Santa Barbara helps cheat. You know, the mountains are there north of L.A. But Santa Barbara's on the coast, and they help push it up. I don't know. I don't think it goes up as far as Santa Cruz or anything. But it goes up pretty far up the coast that way from there. So it's a damn good spot. KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., the Pacifica station there. And in fact, I tell you guys this, I sent an email to Alan Minsky, the program director at KPFK, and they have this thing. It's a website that is the Pacifica station's website for distributing Pacifica shows between Pacifica stations. And so I always post every week's show up on there too. And so I asked Alan Minsky, hey man, so is there any record? Do you know which other Pacifica stations are actually getting the show and playing it and when? And I don't know all the details, but he sent me back this long list of Pacifica stations. I went and he said some of them are playing the show regularly on a weekly basis and have been. Others are playing them on kind of a more hit and miss basis, but It was a long list. I don't know, man. Dozen stations, I guess. Pacifica stations around the country, including in Washington, D.C. So that's pretty good, man. I didn't realize that. So anti-war radio on Pacifica station near you, if you got one. See, there isn't one in Austin, I don't think. But anyway, Houston has a Pacifica station. They got the population to support one. All right, so yeah, that's pretty cool. That'll be back Sunday morning, 8:30 LA time. If you like stuff like that. All right, so now back to the wars here. Hagel blasts Obama for not making plain his Syria strategy. Well, but whose fault is that? I mean, are they not having meetings in the White House where the Secretary of Defense is saying to the president, hey, man, what are we doing about Assad? Are we going to be like George W. Bush and befriend him and pay him to torture and murder jihadist guys for us? Or are we going to back the jihadists in their campaign of torture and murder of everybody else who supports Assad like George Bush used to? Huh? Which is it? Huh? 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 And if he doesn't like it, why doesn't he resign? And if he wants regime change, why doesn't he say, yes, I think that the fight against the Islamic State would be a lot easier if we got rid of their number one enemy, Bashar al-Assad, first. Go ahead and say that, if that's what you're saying, traitor. And if he's saying, listen, just because Israel hates Assad, that doesn't mean that that should have anything to do with our policy at all. Assad is horrible, but the Islamic State and their buddies in the al-Nusra Front, they are the enemy. At least that would make sense. I've said a thousand times, I'm still saying, I'm not for backing Assad. I've always been opposed to backing Assad. I'm against the existence of the U.S. national government in any sense. So how in the hell is the invisible man supposed to back Assad? I'm not saying that. But backing the rebels against him this whole time has been high treason. There's no other way to say it. And that's what is the basis of Hegel's frustration. He's guilty of treason, too. All of these guys are having a tough time figuring out how to manage this cognitive dissonance. How to be enemies of Assad and ISIS at the same time when they're on opposite sides in a civil war. And for that matter, America's entire policy in the Middle East, in terms of the sectarian civil war, which is exactly what it is at its core, it's Riyadh versus Tehran. And America is on both sides. It's our allies in Saudi who are backing the Mujahideen, along with our allies, the Turks and the Qataris, backing the Mujahideen, while America, again, has been backing Assad, at least up through 2011. Bill Clinton and George W. Bush paid Assad to kill these guys. Assad, who is allies with Iran, who America fought an 8-year war for in Iraq. And America's intervening on the side of in Iraq again right now. And it was our friends in the Mujahideen blowing back that knocked the towers down. But we're supposed to prioritize Israel's enemies, the Shiites, led by the Iranians. And here, Chuck Hagel, I mean, how is this even possible that this is an argument, that this is news, that the Secretary of Defense wants a clear policy of on Syria but won't say what he wants it to be? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So yeah, here's another one on Hagel. This is at Military.com. Hagel, U.S. faces setbacks and complications in ISIS fight. Yeah, you think so? So to skip to the part about what we were just talking about, last month, Congress approved $500 million for the effort to train about 5,000 troops, Mujahideen, moderate rebels, a militia, not troops, a militia, 5,000 at sites in Saudi Arabia and possibly Turkey for a new Syrian force. Quote, recruiting and vetting has not yet begun for the Syrian force, but a command and control apparatus was forming and sites for the training had been selected, Dempsey said. Both Hagel and Dempsey sought to downplay published reports of friction, da-da-da. No, that was it. So that's it. They have yet to enroll any recruits for the proposed moderate force. They've announced it won't be the Free Syrian Army. It's going to be a brand new group of so-called moderates. Oh, what, the Al-Farouk Brigade cannibals and the Northern Storm Brigade kidnappers aren't moderate enough for you? They have cut the, according to Roy Gutman's reporting from McClatchy Newspapers, and I think others have, you know, since verified this, they've cut the Free Syrian Army leadership in Turkey out of the chain, and the CIA is now directly handling Free Syrian Army militia units in northern and in southern Syria themselves, because there is no army or organization for them to work with. They gotta, you know, put CIA, I guess, paramilitary types right there on the ground. That usually, what, means former special forces hired as contractors by the CIA or something? Going to run these guys themselves. Because there's no leadership that they can count on whatsoever. This is, what they're saying is a, you know, sometimes, occasionally, once in a while, it occurs to me again that, you know, this is really serious. This is a war. I mean, I know it's the same old crap day in and day out. Believe me, it feels that way to me. But this is absolutely mad that America is getting into a war where we can get to the Iraq side of the equation in a second, but the Syria side of this policy is absolutely ridiculous on its face. Train up a new militia to fight Assad and Hezbollah on one side and Nusra and ISIS on the other. Now, they did have this report that they want to train up this new force and then have them make peace with Assad and fight ISIS together. Well, who are they going to train to do that? The moderate Syrian army they're looking for is the Syrian army. I'm sorry. They're not moderate. They're mass murderers, but they're centrists. They're coalition builder types. You know, they'll kill you if you won't join up. But they are a secular army, basically. It's not a Shiite religious army like the Iranian Revolutionary Guards or something like that. The country is ruled by Alawites, which that's a sect of the Shiites, but they also kind of pre-exist Islam. But so they're, you know, more or less sort of kind of a break-off sect of the Shiites in a way. Whatever. They're the dominant clique, and then they're in alliance with the Shiites, the Christians, and some of the Kurds, etc. So, you know, and it's not like the Alawites have a revolutionary, you know, ideological, evangelical kind of bent to them or anything. They're not waging jihad. They're just trying to protect their power. And, well, and themselves. I'll tell you what, if the secular Baathist government in Damascus does fall, you're going to see the tragedy of the Syrian civil war that's existed over the last 3 years, 3.5 years, get so much worse. Right now, the civilian... the Sunni civilian population is not very safe. You know, the Syrian army bombs the hell out of them if they're anywhere near FSA, Nusra, or ISIS targets. But most of the civilian population that supports the regime has been safe. Most, I said. has been safe, protected by the Syrian army. But if the Syrian army is gone and the Syrian state falls, then, and, you know, Nusra and ISIS become dominant all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, holy crap, you've not even begun to see heads lopped off yet. The Christians and the Shiites and the Alawites, the civilians who would stand to be butchered by these jihadists. But so, that's the policy. America's policy. Now, I don't know, man. On the other hand, and there, it's a big on the other hand. On the other hand, that's crazy. And that's really what we have here. We have crazy versus, you know, horrible but reasonable and the only choice. And I mean, within the assumptions of the empire has to do something about the Islamic State. Putting that aside for argument's sake, the only sane thing for him to do is to back Assad there in Syria. Certainly not keep backing people against him. But on the other side of that, the crazy side of that is it's not so crazy. Well, actually it is. It's crazy and stupid and horrible from the Israeli point of view, but I guess that's why they insist on it. And I guess, you know, the Saudis don't really have anything to lose and only things to gain by getting rid of the Baathists. So it makes sense from their point of view to keep up this policy. But it's absolutely crazy if the stated goal actually is the goal, and that is degrading and destroying the Islamic State. How can they get into a war when it's, you know, it's like if they remember Kennedy's coup d'etat against Diem in 1963, just a couple of weeks before the same thing apparently happened to him. Speaking of Malcolm X and chickens coming home to roost and all that. Oh, wait, we weren't speaking of that. But anyway, what if they had announced the policy in the first place was, yeah, we're going to invade South Vietnam, not we're going to, you know, send our peace troops to help advise them and whatever. They just said, we're going to invade South Vietnam and we're going to overthrow the regime in South Vietnam and put in the new regime. And then we're going to fight to keep the communists out. What if they had announced that that was their policy in the first place, say in 1960, 61? Wouldn't that strike you as a little bit nonsensical? Wait, we're going to invade the south of this country to keep the north out of it. But apparently we agree with the north about the uselessness of the government of the south so bad that we're going to go ahead and overthrow it ourselves. Obviously, once you got tens of thousands of troops in there, it makes it a little harder to turn it around. But what madness is that? Here we're fighting. We got a declared pseudo, at least presidentially, declared war and certainly a consensus in D.C. for war against the Islamic State. While at the same time continuing to try to overthrow the government in Damascus. It's so out of control. It's completely ridiculous. So, and there are indications, as I keep mentioning, that Obama or at least part of the government in some sense has sided with horrible reason over complete madness. Like we were talking about on the show yesterday, Patrick Coburn reporting that they're giving intel on ISIS targets to Assad through the Germans. They clearly have, you know, some kind of wink nod thing about, yeah, we're flying airstrikes over your country and you're not going to give us a problem over it because we're fighting your enemies. But man, it just can't be denied how much controversy there is over this in Washington, D.C. right now. It's amazing to me that people are saying, oh my God, you know, like the quote in that last article here where, you know, there all these experts, the consensus of the criticism of the administration is that he is in effect bolstering Assad's position by striking the Islamic State without also striking the Syrian government. That's the criticism. I mean, if I was making that up as my crazy conspiracy theory, that that's what the American political establishment wants out of this, You'd think I was crazy, but here it is, a Yahoo News, man. I'm the outlier on this. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroca, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroca by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. In case you're tuning in late, the news is I'm cutting the third hour off the end of the show here, starting Monday. Going back to just 2 hours. Because I just got too much other stuff to do, man. I got to. Later on the show today, Antonio Bueller will be on to talk about his acquittal for filming the cops, brutalizing some lady. All right. So that's happening. And also coming up on my show, no one is going to email me back to even say no, I guess. Ali Gharib emailed me back to say no. He had a good excuse. He's busy writing another thing. Well, here I am trying to interview him about the last thing he wrote. All right, well, I don't know. I waited way too long, man. I need to get back in the habit of lining people up on the show more than, say, 10 minutes before the show starts, you know. Kind of help things out a little bit. All right, let me just say one thing real quick about the Ebola thing. I'm not too concerned about it personally, even though, you know, that's a lot of people have it right now. So, in the world. So, you know, it could get around. It could get much worse. It could spread to India. You know, it could spread to massive kind of slum cities, you know, like, what about outside of Rio de Janeiro, where everybody just lives in a cardboard box? That kind of crap. It could get pretty ugly if it spreads around, you know. Right now, I'm not too worried about it. But the thing that I wanted to comment on is all the controversy over the nurses and the quarantine and all that. And I don't know all the details, but I guess my understanding is here's a nurse who is so selfless, or maybe so selfish for her resume's sake, but I don't think so, right? Here, she's so selfless, she travels to West Africa to help treat people with Ebola. But then when she comes home, she's so selfish, she won't admit that there is a chance that she's got the infection. She's been palling around with Ebolaites. And there's a chance that the symptoms haven't begun to show yet. And like, hey, man, how about a decent respect for everybody else that, like, you know, you govern yourself so that nobody has to boss you around. Who are these doctors and nurses who are caring for people with Ebola, and then they're traveling on subways and airplanes and cruise ships and going around and insisting on being around other people? Just stay at home for 3 weeks, man. You know, and this is not an argument about whether Chris Christie, the Nazi, has a right to imprison these people this way or that. I'm just saying, what kind of selfish idiot acts that way? Yes, I've been caring for people with Ebola, but I just figured that, you know what, if I'm on this standing room only subway with you guys all week, who cares, right? It's probably okay. Well, hey, man. I don't know. Human beings are some crazy kind of monkey, dude. I just, you know, here's my thing. You ever watch the Meerkat Manor? If you ever watch the Meerkat Manor, it's like this kind of rodent sort of, mammalian thing that lives in a giant termite mound in the savannas of Africa somewhere. It's like a little prairie dog kind of a thing, only it's really tall. And anyway, they have a whole show. It's narrated by Sam Gamgee from the Lord of the Rings movies there. And what happens is, of course, they personify the meerkats and speak of them, name them, and name their roles like this. This meerkat is the auntie of these two meerkats, and this one is the stepfather of these other two meerkats and the cousins and this kind of thing, and personify their behavior so much. If you watch that show very much, You start to think of them as human. If you watch it much longer and then you start reading the news I'm reading, you start wondering whether maybe we need to start meerkatizing humans. And that really maybe it's just one or two notches up from there is where we're at right now. And you can't really expect better human behavior than the kind of completely ridiculous stuff that people do. You know? Lady travels halfway across the world to go care for people dying of a horribly deadly disease. And then she comes back and her message to all of her neighbors is, suck it if you don't like it. I go where I want and do what I want and blah, blah, blah. Hey, we know it's got like a 3-week incubation thing. Why don't you just stay home, man? Please? I don't know. People are stupid, dude. That's why everybody does everything. I learned that watching TV. All right, now, so back to the war here, because that's what matters. I want to look at this. I haven't looked at this. I didn't even know this happened until I saw some reference to it on Twitter. I really need to get a subscription and start looking at the Wall Street Journal every day. Not the editorial page. I just couldn't stand it. I'm watching Fox News. That's enough. Thanks. But they do have good reporters there, or at least reporters who do in-depth work based on, you know, their own kind of Wall Street Journal-ish Murdochian assumptions, but it's all right. I like reading through lines. It's okay between them. But, you know, it's a confusing thing. I'd like to figure out who would even be the right person to parse this, man. I wish Bob Dreyfus still liked me. I used to love talking to that guy, man. Here the Wall Street Journal says, oh yeah, America has a deal with the Saudis. You join our coalition against ISIS and we will double down with you in your Cold War and worse against Syria and your Cold War with Iran. Well, here is U.S.-Iran relations move to detente. Interests align over fight against Islamic State, other policies. Oh man, well no, I don't want an alliance with Iran. Well, look, again, for the millionth time, aligning with sectarian Shiite forces in Iraq against the Islamic State is a, first of all, absolutely horribly immoral policy. Especially when you consider who the Badr Brigade, the Mahdi Army, and these other militias are, and what we already know about them and their tortures and murders. I mean, these guys are monsters as bad as the Islamic State on the other side. And backing Iranian backed Shiite revolutionary and religiously sectarian forces against the Islamic State is only going to rally more and more people to their cause. In fact, that story is coming up next. But detente, I like. I mean, hell, we could have peace with Iran. We could have a detente means cooling off, which means like a half a peace. You know, peaceful coexistence, if not outright, you know, friendly recognition. But for God's sake, resolve the nuclear deal, right? Don't ally with them against the Islamic State. Now sit back and let them fight the Islamic State and make it their own problem. I don't care about that, really, but just don't help them. But of course, I don't ever get it my way. The Obama administration and Iran. Engaged in direct nuclear negotiations and facing a common threat from Islamic State militants have moved into an effective state of detente over the past year, according to senior U.S. and Arab officials. That doesn't mean Iranian ones. The shift could drastically alter the balance of power in the region and risks alienating key U.S. allies such as Saudi and the United Arab Emirates, who are central to the coalition fighting the Islamic State. Yeah, like they're doing anything. Sunni Arab leaders view the threat posed by Shiite Iran as equal to or greater than that. Okay, so all this is really is just propaganda against the nuclear deal. Right? Or I don't know, they say they're citing senior U.S. officials, but that's pretty vague. Are these people speaking for Obama and they're taking credit for this and saying, yes, that's right, we're achieving a peace here? Or this is just their Saudi-aligned critics on the other side of the war over there. Israel contends the U.S. has weakened the terms of its negotiations with Iran and played down Tehran's destabilizing role in the region. Over the past decade... Oh, man, we gotta go. Man, I can barely hear that. All right, well, I'm back in a minute. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Okay, great, man. We're going to have Ray McGovern on in 10 minutes, guys. Well, that's not a 100%, but that's about a 90%, okay? Cool, man. The heroic Ray McGovern. Hopefully, that's coming up on the show here. All right. So now, I don't know. What a goddamn mess. American foreign policy in the Middle East is such a freaking mess right now. And I know that there are people who think it's all on purpose, but, I mean, each thing that they do is deliberate and they're guilty. I don't mean any of it's, you know, accidental or whatever, but I just think that everything that they do is stupid and wrong. And I think that, just look at the way the Bush administration went ahead and aligned with the Badr Corps. The Iraqi traitors who lived in Iran for 30 years were determined to murder every last Sunni in Baghdad until they got the hell out. I mean, what the hell policy was that? And, I mean, really what happened was they tried to set up this caucus system and they ended up dividing people by sect in a way that they were trying to make sure it was like a confessional system like in Lebanon where they would have enough of everybody represented. Instead of just treating everybody like an Iraqi and hoping it worked out that way. But then it didn't even matter either way because the Ayatollah Sistani came out in January of 2004. And he said, hey, if you believe in God, go outside and demand one man, one vote. And so here's the highest ranking religious authority in all of Shiism on earth. And so the Shiites all went outside. And basically the message to Bush very politely stated... not like this, but the paraphrase and the signal was loud and clear. You're going to have to start this war all over again if you think you're going to deny us the power in Baghdad. And so Bush at that point had a choice. Him and his people had a choice. Well, they could just leave and say, fight your own civil war and figure this out for yourself. Or they could become the Ayatollah's sock puppets. And so they became the Ayatollah's sock puppets. And then in 04, they let him and his men write, well, not really Sistani himself, but all Sistani-approved types from the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawah Party, let them write the Constitution, in alliance with Muqtada Sadr, let them write the Constitution, let them, you know, win the supermajority election. They didn't postpone the election, even though it was clear that the Sunnis were going to completely boycott it. They went ahead and held the election. Even John Stewart was like, wow, look at all those purple fingers. That was just day one of the Civil War right there. And America, George Bush and his government had the American military serve as the proxies. Now, I know they didn't see it that way, but that's the real truth of it. Who rules Baghdad now, America or the Iranian-backed Shiite militias? Right, exactly. Because George Bush's Army and Marine Corps gave it to them. You know, I remember, too, even having soldiers who would say, hey, we're helping the people against the terrorists and create a democracy. And I would say, no, you're backing these factions and those factions. And occasionally they would go, oh. Or I'd even hear back, months or years later and say, man, I guess more likely months later. Yeah, I guess you're right about that. I realize that actually what we are doing is creating these sectarian ghettos in the capital city here and et cetera, et cetera. I can't get over this. I know it's a tangent. I say it all the time, and it's kind of off course of any kind of compelling narrative, but I still can't get over it. It's so infuriating to me. If you read the book, The Good Soldiers, by Finkel from the Washington Post, it's a profile. He was embedded with this group of guys because Larich was the lieutenant colonel who was in charge of this. I think it's a brigade. I forget the... All those designations, guys, forgive me. Battalion or something. But Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich, and yes, he's a guilty war criminal. I got two on this show. I got two sworn eyewitnesses to him demanding that his soldiers carry out war crimes and kill any civilians who happen to be around wherever a bomb goes off as collective punishment for any attack against them. And that's Ethan McCord and Josh Stieber both told me that he told them that. And I followed up. Wait, you kind of heard that that was what he wanted, or you heard and saw him say that with your own eyes and ears? The latter. In both cases. The war criminal. Kozlarich. And anyway, these guys were fighting in Sadr City and in East Baghdad, and I guess, I'm not sure if they were fighting in Najaf, but part of the same operations going on in Najaf around the same time too, fighting against Muqtada al-Sadr. Now, Muqtada al-Sadr is a brutal killer. He's a sick bastard. But that's not what matters. What matters is that politically, he was anti-American and anti-Iranian. And he didn't want a Sunni-Shia split. He didn't want to fight a sectarian civil war. Now, I'm sure he wanted the Shiites to be dominant in the new government. They are the 60% majority of the country, 20% Kurd and 20% Sunni. But he didn't want the whole mass slaughter, civil war kind of thing. He wanted a Iraqi nationalist Arab government at the expense of Iran and the U.S. So what did the U.S. do? They accused him of being the Iranian stooge, while they were the ones who were the Iranian stooges, backing the Iranian stooges, Dawa, and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and their Badr Brigade. They were the Iraqi traitors who'd lived in Iran for 30 years, who fought on Iran's side in the Jimmy Carter and Reagan-backed Iraqi war against Iran. And so America accused Sadr of being the Iranian-backed one and declared war on him, even though he was one-third of the ruling coalition. He still is. His men are part of, well, I don't know, it all broke apart, the State of Law Party and this and that. But they still have the United Iraqi Alliance, which is the Supreme Islamic Council and Muqtada al-Sadr. And at that time, before Maliki and the State of Law Party had broken off, and he just had made his own, pardon me, his own breakoff party from Dawa, the United Iraqi Alliance was the three: the Supreme Islamic Council, the Muqtada al-Sadr, and the Dawa Party. And the reason they compromised on the Dawa Party is because they didn't have their own army, and Sadr had his own army, and Hakim, the leader of the Supreme Islamic Council, had his own army, so they had compromised on Dawa, so that then they would incorporate the Mahdi army and the Badr Brigade into the new Iraqi army, basically as a compromise deal. But anyway, America, there they were, and these guys, this book, The Good Soldiers, tells the story of the individual men. The most of them, you know, 19 and 20 year old kids. To me, now that I'm in my late 30s, a 19 year old, a 20 year old is a child almost. No, I'm not saying they're not responsible for their actions or whatever, but they sure are dumb and naive and couldn't possibly really comprehend the situation that they're in. And the book really, I think, shows that. This is the same brigade that is depicted in the collateral murder video, the WikiLeaks Apache slaughter video. Ethan McCord was the guy who, one of the guys on the ground who helped rescue the children that his fellows in the helicopter had shot. But anyway, throughout that whole book, they're fighting their ally, Sadr, and they don't even know it. And they're getting their legs blown off, they're getting killed, they're killing people, they're being ordered to commit war crimes in a war against the guy they're fighting for. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm trying to get Ray. He's busy. He's got an interview with RT. He's doing him. Texting back with a stranger here. I'm trying to work it out. All right. Well, anyway, keep that in front of me here. I'm Scott Horton. My website is scotthorton.org. Sign up for the podcast feed there. You can get the whole show archives or just the interviews. There are more than 3,500 of them in the archives, by the way, if you want to go back. But yeah, join up the podcast feed there. And never miss a show. Join up the chat room if you want. It's kind of a small crowd in there today. Hey, everybody. scotthorton.org/chat if you want to hang out during the show. Again, starting Monday, I'm coming back to 2 hours because I just got to. I really would rather go to four. Man, I really would rather go to four. I just can't do that. It just isn't going to work. I got to go the other way. Too many other things. All right, so. Let's talk about this one. From The Guardian, foreign jihadists flocking to Iraq and Syria on an unprecedented scale, claims the United Nations. UN report suggests decline of al-Qaeda has yielded an explosion of jihadist enthusiasm for its even mightier successor organizations, chiefly ISIS. Again, this is The Guardian. Oh, I got a Texas guy back. Jeez, I said already. Yeah, trying to get Ray on. Sorry. So, the UN has warned that foreign jihadists are swarming into the twin conflicts in Iraq and Syria on an unprecedented scale from countries that have not previously contributed combatants to global terrorism. A report by the UN Security Council, obtained by The Guardian, finds that 15,000 people have traveled to Syria and Iraq to fight alongside the Islamic State and similar extremist groups. They come from more than 80 countries, the report states, including a tale of countries that have not previously faced challenges related to al-Qaeda. You know, I was telling you 2 years ago there were Afghan Mujahideen traveling to fight on America's side in Syria, where America's on the side of the Mujahideen because Obama's a traitor. Not that Obama's loyal to them. Just like George Bush serving the Ayatollah in Iraq, he was serving Osama too, both unintentionally. Obama more intentionally. And Bush really intentionally with the serving the Ayatollah, unintentionally with the serving Osama thing in Iraq, I think. Obama certainly serving Osama and knowing it all along for the last 3 years in Libya, and then in Syria, pretending that they're the ones. Hey, we're the world empire, so it's what we want that goes, right? Mm-hmm. And where you had some Mujahideen who traveled to Iraq to fight back in Iraq War II, 15,000 now? Could it possibly be that many? What if it's half of that? Still. And mostly that's from the region, but that's a lot of Europeans, too. People who've grown up in this whole wartime. It's an amazing thing. And, you know, there's a great article that you can find at the Christian Science Monitor and at the Wall Street Journal, in fact, from back in 2005 about dual Israeli and Saudi studies that were done that both concluded the same thing. And that was that virtually all, as in 99% of all the Mujahideen who had gone to fight in the Iraq War, in Iraq War II, on the side of the Sunni-based insurgency, aligned with, of course, Zarqawi and al-Qaeda in Iraq, they were all young guys who'd been radicalized by the invasion itself, starting in 2003. Not even necessarily radicalized by the blockade and the starvation and the bombing and all the killing under Bill Clinton. It was the invasion of 03 that had radicalized an entire new generation. And then, of course, as Matthew Alexander, the former army interrogator, that's a pseudonym, but according to his very detailed, incredible explanations and testimony, all the foreign fighters he interviewed said they were there because of the invasion and especially because of the pictures of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. and the dehumanizing and the torture and the mistreatment of innocent Muslims. And they thought, hey, this is their duty to go and fight. And that's what they were doing there. The only thing that the old Mujahideen from the old Afghan war, from back when they were friends with Ronald Reagan, had to do with it was kind of coordinating things, you know, the logistics and the money and doing the fundraising and sending the young guys off. But they were all new guys. And that was 9 years ago when those studies came out. So these are all new guys who come from post-2003 on. Now, we know the current leader of the Islamic State, the self-declared Caliph Ibrahim, was turned into the monster he is in Camp Buka in 2005, where he was arrested in back to the Badr Brigade, Donald Rumsfeld hiring the Badr Brigade to go and hunt down the leaders of the Sunni-based insurgency. And what that really meant was just rounding up fighting-age males and anybody they're associated with, rounding up Sunnis by the thousands and thousands and thousands. The army themselves later admitted their numbers, 90% of the people that they had arrested were perfectly innocent. They were guilty only of being Sunnis in Sunni, you know, majority towns who happened to be grabbed by the U.S. Army working in conjunction with the Badr Brigade. And that's where the Islamic State comes from. I mentioned the other day this article by the Soufan group from the former FBI agent Ali Soufan, who talks about how in 2005 you had all these Ba'athist generals and all these proto-Bin Ladenites all imprisoned together, and I don't know the details, but surely mistreated together in there. And that was where the current generation of the Islamic State comes from. It's just Al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's just Al-Qaeda in Iraq 8 years later, 9 years later. And anyway, so now, where in the last war you only had, I don't know, maybe low numbers of thousands of Libyans, Saudis, Syrians, and others going to fight, now you've got apparently many more. As much as 15,000, I don't know. Who really knows about those numbers? But I don't know, that sounds about plausible to me, considering how fast this thing has been growing over the last couple of years. Considering the fact that Obama overthrew Gaddafi and has worked so hard all this time to weaken Assad in Syria. It's been a huge boon. This whole war has been a huge boon to these guys. I mean, that's what they are. They're fighters. They don't have any other skills, really. And it's just, and ever since the airstrikes, in fact, I saw a very hawkish CIA expert, former CIA agent, they identified him as, Baker, I think his name was, on Fox News this morning. And the question from Lip Gloss Girl was, well, how come the airstrikes aren't doing enough? And I think she's throwing a softball because Fox News' line is, we must invade, right? So she's saying, how come the airstrikes aren't doing enough? And he says, if anything, the airstrikes have helped the recruitment for the other side. If anything, it has just helped their side of the war, not ours at all. Then I forgot his exact words. In fact, I had it on the tip of my tongue a second ago. It wasn't a rallying cry. It was a better term than that. Same difference. That's what he meant, though. The airstrikes, just like I told you before they started, intervening in this war is what they want. It's already working in their favor. And it's guaranteed at this point to go on for decades. At this rate, I guess I should say. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. So, hey, man, did you guys see this article by Greenwald and them about Matt Taibbi leaving First Look Media? He's now returning to Rolling Stone, according to The Guardian. So First Look, that's Pierre Omidyar, the eBay billionaire who set up this thing with Greenwald. They got The Intercept. That's Greenwald, Scahill, and Poitras and their associates. And then Taibbi was going to be on, you know, his own Greenwaldian level with his own separate thing. And Taibbi, as you may be aware, wrote all that great stuff for Rolling Stone about all the evil pigs on Wall Street. And especially Goldman Sachs and all that stuff. So anyway, the whole thing fell apart. And, you know, Greenwald and the rest of them, they all wrote up this thing just completely denouncing the boss and blaming the boss and all his people for ruining everything. And it makes that Omidyar guy sound like a lunatic. And, in fact, the piece ends with, yeah, man, I mean, it is still an unresolved problem of how to do well-funded and yet independent journalism. It's got to get done. Not every journalist is good enough to break the real stories. And some of the, and so they've got a supply and demand problem there. They need to be paid well to do the best work. And yet, but we also all recognize they have to be able to write about what they want. And do things the way that they want to a great degree, or else they're just sock puppet propagandists of someone else. They need to be able to write that the boss can go to hell and still get away with that to some degree, something. It's extremely difficult. You know? And as you, as there are more and more, you know, new rich fortunes being inherited, I guess you'll see more and more attempts. I don't know. People like Omidyar breaking off from what they really do to try to do this instead, I don't know. But somebody like, I don't know, Omidyar's son someday, deciding that that's what he wants to do with his fortune is create some independent media with a lot of money behind it, something like that. Yeah, these things can happen, you know, as the people that run all the old systems finally just die off of old age or, you know, whatever. You know, it's a real disappointment, isn't it? That here, this guy Omidyar, I mean, surely he must have had some idea what he was getting into, hiring a bunch of people who want to be very independent. And you know, Greenwald told him, hey, man, I had the same deal with The Guardian. I insist on the same deal with The Guardian I had on Salon.com. I publish what I want. The most extreme circumstance, you can come to me after the fact. But nobody gets to check my work before I hit publish or I'm not doing it. You know, that's how his attitude is from the beginning. So the idea was that that was Omidyar's attitude too. That was what he wanted to fund, was something like that. Go out there and turn stuff upside down. Here's some money to do it with. And yet, you read the article, and it's Greenwald and his people that wrote this article, just 1,000% taking Taibbi's side against, and because I think the truth is on Taibbi's side, reality is on Taibbi's side, in describing this guy Omidyar's, the way that he tried to run this business as being absolutely crazy. And the, and Greenwald, et cetera, write that they fought with Omidyar and his people all summer long about how The Intercept is supposed to work. And they finally got their difficulties ironed out. They finally got his people to back off enough to let them run the business the way they want. That now, as you may have noticed, they've got some good new hires and they're being much more productive. And people were wondering what the hell is taking so long over there. And now they're finally starting to get their ass in gear. So, but then they lament that Taibbi was unable to come to such an understanding with these guys and talk about, you know, seating assignments and the color of which kind of highlighter you use. And the CEO of eBay, or the, this guy, that, I don't know if he's still a CEO of eBay, whoever he is, this giant zillionaire who's funding this thing, personally going over the receipts from the office supply store, going over every hire and every decision and every kind of thing that's, man, just what are we even doing? And then so now, thank goodness he didn't burn any bridges at Rolling Stone, and he apparently has a brand new huge piece that he's just handed them. Here you go, guys. I got a brand new huge piece. Let's read over it together. You like it? All right. And they're putting it in the new Rolling Stone, which comes out next week. So, well, so much for Pierre Omidyar over there. I don't know. I guess Greenwald, you know, I know that there are people who have their criticisms of Greenwald for, you know, whatever it is, but I still like him. And I think that if he ever thought that he wasn't going to be able to resolve independence issues, I'm sure he would just quit. And the guy already made enough money as a lawyer. I don't know how much they were paying him to write at Salon.com, but he owns a nice, you know, house in the jungle down there in Rio. I think he's doing okay. I don't really know. But he was a lawyer in New York for quite a while before he ever became a writer. And I don't think he's hurting for work so bad that he's going to put up with a bunch of crap. And I also don't think he's motivated by, you know, fortune as his motivation for getting up in the morning and doing what he does anyway. So I'm sure if it comes down to it, he'll tell Omidyar to go to hell. And in fact, what he and his colleagues wrote at The Intercept yesterday about what happened with Taibbi may be the end of the deal right there. Because he sure doesn't make the boss look good there at all. So, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Well, see, that's why I make no money and have no audience and do what I want and say what I want and go off and on any tangent I want. I don't know. I thought about, you know, like trying to somehow write up a grant, like trick George Soros into giving me some money, and then I would have to do a lot of shows about what scum he is and how horrible all his projects are for long enough in a row that people wouldn't think I was tainted anymore about it. But then, you know, I would have the money because I like money. But then, nah, I just never got around to doing that because that just doesn't make any sense. And that'd be the wrong thing to do anyway. Take money from even a bad guy to stab him in the back with. Yeah, I'll break that way. But how do you make enough money and do alternative media? It's a real problem for a lot of people. But hey, it is what it is. All right, coming up on the show, Ray McGovern. That's in about 20 minutes from now. He's going to be on about what the pigs did to him there in New York when he tried to protest David Petraeus. And, you know, I really wanted to get Trevor Tim on. And I really wanted to get Jeff Kay on. There's the torture thing where Obama wants to rewrite the torture law. Gotta interview Kay about that. That won't be till next week, I guess. And then Trevor Tim had all this stuff on the FBI. All kinds of... Boy, that's the ugliest BI ever. All kinds of... New police state news to cover on the show with Trevor Tim. High-tech police state stuff he's been writing about for The Guardian. All right. I guess we can talk about Palestine for a minute. Observers took hundreds of testimonies to compile reports on human shields and indiscriminate targeting of non-combatants. Of course, the Israelis, everything they're ever accusing their enemies of doing is always just what they're doing. Apparently, the thinking is this. God, it sure is horrible of us to make this teenage civilian kid walk in front of us as we invade his neighborhood and kill people. You know, that's such a horrible thing to do that we ought to accuse them of doing it. I know. Let's accuse them of doing it all day. Every minute on the minute. Oh, Hamas is using human shields. Human shields. Human shields, human shields, human shields. Why, the fact that Hamas guys are getting killed in cities where there are civilians, well, that means that they are using human shields. No, it's the Israelis. And there's a whole brand new study about that. Israeli matrix of control, use of Palestinian civilians as human shields. the Euromid Human Rights Observer in Geneva. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up in just a few, Ray McGovern will be here to talk about what happened last night. Stick around for that. And then Antonio Bueller is going to be on the show from the Peaceful Streets Project to talk about his acquittal. So that's pretty good. And now, a little bit more Israel news here. First of all, so there's this, the Geneva-based Euromid Human Rights Observer. And they have done this report. It says that the Israeli army broke international law on at least six occasions in the southern Gaza Strip in August, where civilians were subjected to, quote, inhumane and abusive treatment. According to the report, they were beaten, exposed to the hot sun, while naked for long periods of time, used as human shields, Israeli matrix of control, use of Palestinian civilians as human shields, is the report. And there you go. So you have a bunch of people who are basically in a tiny little urban pen, and the fact that they're in an urban environment becomes their death warrant, and I mean, not just in effect, but no, literally. There are no innocent civilians because they're near Hamas. And the reason they're near Hamas is because Hamas is using them as human shields. But of course, they wouldn't think for a moment that, hey, if Hamas is using someone as a human shield, that, well, maybe you need to not kill those human shields and figure out a way to wait, get a better angle, send in a sniper team. Nope. They have the right, the Israelis, they claim, to kill anyone in the Gaza Strip that they feel like, because everyone is in proximity to Hamas. And because Hamas is in the Gaza Strip, that makes them all human shields and all of their lives forfeit. But meanwhile, who actually is using human shields? The Israelis. And there were reports back during the war in July. Not that it was, the war was confined to July, but I just mean this, some report I was thinking of, a couple of reports about the Israelis. One method of using human shields that they would do is fire from one building that they're occupying on a building two buildings away. And maybe there are Hamas fighters in that building two buildings away. But meanwhile, there's a building full of Palestinian civilians in between them. And the Hamas fighters don't fight back, don't want to shoot back and undermine, not that they really care, probably. They're politicians, after all, soldiers, but it's bad PR if they're killing their own people. So they got to hold their fire, and the Israelis can just sit there and blast them because they have human shields to protect them. And I don't know if that's in this specific report. It's different, but, you know, there's just... It's madness, the way that that Gaza war, well, the entire situation from beginning to end is madness, but that Gaza war is just, as this guy says, complete injustice. It's treating people absolutely like animals, and I think it's symbolic of how the Israeli military sees Palestinians, said Perkis from the group. Yeah, agreed. Horror. You imagine... If the Israeli army did that to somebody in your family, strapped your nephew to the hood of their Jeep as they went driving through, blasting people, and forced your niece to go through tunnels and looking for Hamas fighters for them to kill. Like when John Kerry walked that old man down the trail in the Mekong Delta at gunpoint so that he would set off any landmines that might have been laid in the road. Oh, yeah, he admitted it. He talked about it. You can read about it at counterpunch.org. Just type in John Kerry Mekong Delta counterpunch old man. You'll find it. That's a human shield. That's a war crime. And then there's Corporal Goldberg in the Atlantic again. Even Israel's best friends understand that it is disconnecting from reality. In this case, in fact, the fact that Jeffrey Goldberg is some kind of left-wing peacenik critic compared to the position of the government of Israel right now ought to be just all you need to know about the situation there. He says in this piece, he's not in favor of a two-state solution. He's not in favor of withdrawal from the West Bank. He may be in favor of some sort of two-state something someday, which is, I think, what we all thought that the Likud policy was, right? The emphasis on someday. But Goldberg is beside himself with the lunacy of the Netanyahu government over there. And he just, you know, he won't let up on it. Well, yeah, he does let up on it. This is a couple in a row now. And I think, actually, probably his whole thing about the administration people talking bad about Netanyahu, he probably provoked them into doing that to help undermine Obama's position on the eve of the final nuclear deal more than anything. Is probably a safe bet there. But anyway, so here he is writing again in the Atlantic, his follow-up piece. It's from today. Even Israel's best friends understand that it's disconnecting from reality, and he's referring to a lead editorial in the New York Jewish Week, the flagship American Jewish newspaper. If you say so, I don't know. I would have thought the foreword or something, right? And anyway, it's a he says it's the flagship. Goldberg says it's the flagship American Jewish newspaper, center to center right in orientation, with many thousands of Orthodox Jews among its readers and an ardently pro-Israel editorial line, bluntly asks whether the Israeli government has become unmoored from reality. The editorial is entitled Bibi Takes on the World and takes note of the recent snub by top American officials of the Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon, a snub prompted by Yaalon's earlier insults directed at Secretary of State John Kerry, and of Netanyahu's government's announcement it would build more than 1,000 new housing units in parts of Jerusalem captured by Israel in 1967. Quote, fully aware, the editorial reads, of the negative response it would receive in America and in the international community. And then, so I guess you guys know a bit of the background about all that, the settlements in the East Jerusalem. I should cover that more, but anyway. Then, so they quote Netanyahu saying that Israel will continue to build in our eternal capital, meaning all of Jerusalem, and screw the Palestinians. Adding, quote, I heard the claim that our building in Jewish neighborhoods in Jerusalem makes peace more distant, but it is the criticism itself that makes peace more distant. He said the criticism feeds the Palestinians false hopes and is, quote, detached from reality. Stop criticizing me as though anything other than the complete colonization of Jerusalem is the policy, when you know all that's doing is helping rile up the Palestinians into believing that someday ever they'll have even part of the eastern half of the city to be the capital of their Palestinian state on the West Bank. That's, you are detached from reality and you're encouraging the Arabs to detach themselves from the reality of the situation, which is never, says Netanyahu. But then the New York Jewish Week drops the hammer, according to Goldberg, and says, it's fair to ask just who's detached from reality these days when you're the tiny little Maryland-sized state undermining the will of the American superpower, which doesn't take kindly to that kind of thing a lot of the time. God dang music playing, now I can't finish the thing. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work, if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us.
All right. We've got that's for offnow.org. You want to hear more about that?
All right, on the line, I got him. It's Ray McGovern. Former CIA analyst for 27 years, used to be the morning CIA briefer for Vice President George H.W. Bush in the 1980s, and he's one of the co-founders of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. You name your foreign policy disaster, and he told you so. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Ray?
Scott, doing all right under the circumstances.
Yeah, well, so let's talk a little bit about those circumstances. You went to see St. David Petraeus, the most successful general in American history, give a talk in New York last night. Is that right?
Yeah, and I was afraid he was going to advertise that, and I noticed there was a Q&A, so I thought I might try to unadvertise it by simply asking a poignant question like, General Petraeus, you indicated many years ago, please tell me how this war ends in Iraq. And now you know, don't you? All those crackerjack troops that you trained up so well and the equipment you gave them and so forth, well, they certainly performed well when a couple of the ISIL guys started shooting AK-47s at them. The officers all got in their helicopters and went to other places, and the troops receded to the point where artillery and the rest of it was left for ISIL, and the U.S. was left in the incredibly ironic and sad position of having to attack its own armaments dedicated to the Iraqi government, lest they fall completely into the hands of ISIL. So we equipped them, we trained them real well. They ran away, literally, four divisions up there. These are the ones that Petraeus bragged about having trained, and then we were reduced to the ridiculous position of having to destroy our own weaponry, but, you know, no problem. That's real good for the military-industrial complex, so we'll just build more weapons and we'll sell them to this new crowd of these Iraqi-trained people that are there at the hand of General Allen. And one of the things I was thinking of asking Petraeus was, hey, are they going to give you a mulligan here? Are you going to get a second try? I mean, here's a no. The new crew of Iraqis. Now, how would they expect a different result this time? So anyhow, there were questions that I didn't think the nice crowd at the 92nd Street Y would ask. So I wanted to go there and ask the question. That's, you know, all $50 for a ticket, which I did. So I was not allowed in.
Wait,
actually, virus.
Say that last sentence and a half over again. Your phone broke up on us a little.
Okay, yeah. I thought that it would be good for someone to ask an intelligent question, a question that might hold this guy accountable for, well, for the untold suffering, untold killing in the hundreds of thousands, including the various surges in Iraq and Afghanistan. A question that would bring the crowd back to reality that he would have to answer in a similar way as the questions I asked Rumsfeld when I had that unique opportunity to debate him for 4 minutes in Atlanta back in 2006. Maybe it was that example that persuaded to Petraeus and or the 92nd Street Y to make sure if McGovern was spotted on the steps trying to get in, don't let him in. For God's sake, don't let Petraeus be asked any real questions. And so I was intercepted, and the cops were called, and I was nursing a really bruised left shoulder, and when they tried to put the cuffs on me behind my back, well, suffice it to say, it was excruciating pain. I screamed like bloody murder because it hurt that much. And so they ended up putting a chain, mind you, a chain of handcuffs on me because there's no way that they could make my left wrist meet my right in the setting of one handcuff. So,
well, that, hang on,
I spent
let me ask you about
prison.
That.
Mm-hmm.
You're
sure.
saying that
mm-hmm.
they didn't handcuff your hands behind your back, or they
no,
finally
they
relented and they let you have a longer
no,
tenure.
No, you know the rules. They had us follow the rules. What I'm saying is that they could not possibly connect my left wrist to my right with mm-hmm. just one set of handcuffs. Ended up doing a chain of them so that linked together, both wrists could be immobilized. But an acknowledgement there simply that there was no way to get the left shoulder to bend far enough without me screaming my head off to get both wrists in one handcuff. So and that's in their records, of course. And
a slight mercy in the midst of a giant outrage. And, of course, they ended up hurting you anyway, as you said. And it's reported that you were crying out in pain on the scene and later at the jail as well.
Well, at the jail, let's see. I took the hospital there, NYU Cornell Hospital, and x-rayed the left shoulder. Luckily, there are no breaks or fractures, but the cup, the rotator cuff and all that stuff can be really, really painful, and that's what it was. It's got a sling on it now, so Ende gut, alles gut, as the Germans say. All's well that ends well. And, I think over something like this, a major action that I really didn't expect. I have this notion that this is at work here and that some good might come out of this. And maybe this is part of it because Petraeus should not be allowed to hide behind.
Right.
I'm
sorry, we lost you after hide behind. He should not be allowed to hide
okay.
behind.
Okay. Hide behind. And his, his Boy Scout ribbons and his merit badges, 10 rows of them, you remember them.
Yeah.
And he should be exposed for what criminal he was. One of the things in just preparing what I knew about Petraeus.
Very quickly.
Was the fact that he went out after the Abu Ghraib scandal, after General Taguba had made his investigation. In June of 2004, with instructions from Donald Rumsfeld, if the Iraqis are torturing one another, that's no problem. You don't have to report that. Just tell the Americans, please, knock off the torture.
Hey,
and
by the way, Ray,
kept...
would it be okay if I interview you for half an hour tomorrow? We could go over all of Petraeus' legacy, the real point here, and talk a little about your shoulder, too.
Yeah, it would have to be more than half an hour.
Well, we're gonna have to all both talk really fast. All right, we'll be right back, everybody, with Antonio Bueller in just a sec. Thanks, Ray.
Great.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is Antonio Bueller. He's the founder of the Peaceful Streets Project at peacefulstreets.com. And he was recently acquitted on charges of failing to obey a police officer just 2 days ago. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
I appreciate you joining us. So, pretty big deal here. Correct me if I'm wrong. This is really the incident that made an activist out of you in the first place, right? You're some guy at 7-Eleven. You see some cops out of line. Then they get even worse out of line directed toward you. And ever since then, Peaceful Streets Project. Is that about the sum of it?
Yeah, that's about it. If it wasn't for that first incident, I never would have pulled out my camera and I never would have concerned myself with police abuse.
All right, so it's a hell of a start there and a hell of a vindication of your actions that night as well, too. So take us through it. The jury agrees with your side, so I don't need a more objective source than you. Tell the story, please.
The story of what happened that night?
Yeah, sure, and all of it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was a designated driver, and I was just taking my buddy home, and we were running out of gas, so I pulled into a gas station. And while we were there, we observed two Austin police officers yank the female passenger of the car. They pulled over out of the car, threw her to the ground, twisting her arms behind her back. We had been watching what was going on, so we knew she hadn't committed a crime. We knew that she hadn't acted aggressively towards anyone. So we knew that this was a textbook assault. And I asked the cops what they were doing, and she immediately said, yelled, "Help me, please." And the cops threatened me, "Worry about yourself, worry about yourself." And then when she started begging me to film, I took out my camera and I tried to take pictures. And because of that, one of the police officers then assaulted me and ultimately charged me with a felony crime of spitting in a cop's face, which took us to this point nearly 3 years later when they tried to get me on the last charge, the last of the three charges that they tried to get me on, which was a lowly Class C misdemeanor for failure to obey a lawful order.
Because the grand jury had failed to even indict you on the spitting charge, right?
Well,
which
what
they charge you? They tried to charge you with assault there?
Yeah, so it's called felony harassment of a public official, but I don't think that they failed to indict me. I think
you know what I mean.
I think it was a well-coordinated event.
I'm sorry, what?
No, I think that was well-coordinated. I think that the district attorney didn't want to deal with this because they knew it was such an absurd case and they didn't want to have it on their hands.
Oh, I see.
But they also wanted to take care of the Austin Police Department and the city of Austin. They still wanted to see me have something hanging over my head, something that would help prevent me from filing a civil lawsuit against the city. So they hit me with that Class C misdemeanor, and that's what took 2 years and nearly 11 months to finally get into a courtroom.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. So that's an important distinction to make there. All right. Now, so let me ask you this. At your blog here, it says that the order that he gave you was illegal because what he was doing to the original victim, Norma Pisana, was illegal in the first place. Can you break that down a little bit? If she had, say, for example, and I'm completely making this up for hypothetical sake, if she had, for example, spit in the cop's face, and so then him being a bit more aggressive toward her in detaining her would then be legal, in that case, it would have been a lawful order for them to tell you to back off?
Not quite, but that's what we argue. The way that the ordinance is written here in Austin is that as long as a police officer tells you something, you have to obey. And then an affirmative defense to that is, well, if the order was unlawful, then you don't have to obey it. But we had to prove that to the jury. And so it was unlawful for many reasons. One is they assaulted Norma. Mm-hmm. Two is, they were infringing upon my First Amendment rights. They were infringing upon my Fourth Amendment rights. So there were actually several layers of why it was unlawful from the police officer's perspective.
Right. Okay, yeah, good point there. And now, so what about Norma? Did she ever get any, you know, responsibility on the part of these cops? Justice?
Yeah. So I think that that's, I'm glad you asked that, because the system is so corrupt and broken that people are congratulating me on not getting convicted of a crime that everyone, including the police officers and the prosecutors, know I didn't commit. And in Norma's case, she doesn't live in Austin. She lives in San Antonio. She's a full-time mom and she has a full-time job. And for her, it was easier for her to say, you know what, if my lawyer can just get these dismissed in exchange for like 8 hours of community service, right, I'll do that. And that's what she did. So technically, the prosecutor grilled her on the stand, the victim of police abuse, he grilled her on the stand for taking a plea deal. And the reality is that most people just don't have the time and the resources to fight it like I did. And so she never got her justice, really. And this decision on my case was the closest that she got.
Mm-hmm. But the prosecutor tried to make it seem like, oh, well, you must have pleaded because you did it and you deserved what you got.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they did. And it was absurd. And the reality is that the state just throws so much resources at convicting innocent people, but they've also been throwing so much resources into the schools to convince people that they have to obey authority, and anyone that the state goes after must therefore be guilty, whether they're terrorists or whether they're, you know, like people who just want to live free, you know, be free of like government regulations. You know, the government convinces society that those people must be in the wrong. And then that just plays out in the jury. And we were very lucky. We had six jury members who I think showed a high level of courage, and they refused to be bullied by the prosecutor. But there's a lot of things about my case that made that possible. And most people just aren't as lucky as I am in being able to not be convicted of crimes they didn't commit.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, and speaking of the jurors, you know, I read in, I think it was in the Austin Chronicle story, that one juror was dismissed because he told the judge he was afraid of both sides, which on one hand, I mean, it seems silly, like that he would be afraid of anyone on your side of thing. Although I guess, you know, just very generally speaking, tensions are high and that kind of thing. So maybe if somebody believes very strongly, they would do something very strongly or something. But what's much more, I mean, that's silly to me, but understandable kind of in a way, not really knowing what he's dealing with. But what's more notable to me there is that the guy has no compunction whatsoever, as well as telling the judge that he's afraid of the police and what they might do to him if he let you go. And so therefore he didn't want to have to make that choice because he'd have to be afraid of the APD for the rest of his life.
Yeah. And so he actually didn't say that he was afraid of both sides. He said that he was afraid and he didn't want to state why he was afraid. And the reality is that he just sat in a trial. He was there for both days of testimony, and he heard that the cops threatened and retaliated against Norma for standing up for her friend, and they did the same to me, and then they threatened to arrest my passenger, Ben. They threatened to arrest a guy across the street, and they ended up threatening and firing the police officer that crossed the thin blue line. And so I think that it was completely rational and reasonable for this guy to be afraid of his safety. He never said who he was afraid of, you know, but when they had upwards of 12 police officers in the courtroom throughout the course of the events, I think that it's obvious who he was afraid of.
Yeah, I see. So, yeah, that was definitely misreported. That wasn't me that screwed that up. That was the story I read, and I believe it was the Chronicle that had the both sides quote there. But, yeah, I mean, it's absurd to think that he would be afraid of you or any of your supporters. You know, when obviously your entire shtick is all about peace, and it's even in the name of your website and everything else, you can clearly see it's not like you had violently resisted these cops or anything like that at the time. But now we got to take this break. We'll be back with more with Antonio Bueller. He was acquitted for standing up to the cops, filming them abusing this poor lady over there at 7-Eleven at 12th and Lamar. And he's the founder of the Peaceful Streets Project. That's peacefulstreets.com. Give us just a minute. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Antonio Bueller from PeacefulStreets.com. And we're talking about his recent acquittal in court here on a misdemeanor charge of failing to obey an officer. It's a jury of six. And they found in his favor. And now two more things at issue here. First of all, real quick, Antonio, could you please speak again to the numbers of police officers who showed up in court on this, and how intimidating you think that may or may not have been to the jury. You mentioned it in reference to that juror wanting out of there and apparently being scared of these cops. I wonder if you think that was really the purpose. And then secondly, please go on and on about the officer that crossed the thin blue line, as you said, and took the stand on your behalf, explaining about the rules for when you can and cannot detain, when a police officer may or may not detain and or arrest someone.
Right. Yeah, so there were at least 12 police officers there. We counted at least six who were in plain clothes, and all of them were confirmed as police officers. And then there were at least six who showed up in uniform. Two of the police officers that were there were assistant police chiefs. So these were pretty high up. I mean, just, you know, at the most senior, most level of the Austin Police Department. And so they spent tax dollars putting these senior police officers in the courtroom for a Class C misdemeanor. I do believe that it was to intimidate the jury. I don't think it was to intimidate the jury to the extent that there would be harm that would befall the jury, but I think it was to intimidate the jury into believing that that the state was right and that it was an important case for the state, and that's why they were there, because it was essential that they get their so-called justice. I think that was more of a show of force, not to threaten with violence, but to threaten, you know, just psychologically.
To threaten them that it would be their fault if the police, our wonderful heroic police, were undermined by their failure to win this one.
Yeah, and it's remarkable the amount of resources they threw into this Class C misdemeanor with a maximum $500 fine. Not only did it last 4 days, almost went into a fifth day, you know, by 5 minutes, then go into a fifth day, but they also had eight city prosecutors in the courtroom during the trial. So there was the city prosecutor who was pushing it, Matthew McCabe, and then he had an assistant city prosecutor who was in there probably about half the time. But then another six city prosecutors, including the lead city prosecutor, also spent significant time in the courtroom. So they were really stacking the courtroom, and this was probably the biggest, you know, misdemeanor case that Austin has ever seen, especially from their position.
Yeah, it sounds like you did the yogurt shop murders or something.
Right. I think that there were more prosecutors here and police officers than there would have been in that case, ironically. Of course, I wasn't there for that. So,
Well, that wasn't a direct challenge to their authority. This is. So if they could charge you with the highest level felony, they would have on that.
Right. And what we know is that they've tried to get me on four different felonies. They tried to get me on the spitting in a cop's face. They tried to get me on racketeering charges. They tried to get me on child endangerment charges. And they tried to get me on online impersonation charges. Now, four different felony charges the Austin Police Department has tried to get me on, all because I stood up to them committing crimes.
Man, all right, I want to get back to the racketeering thing and that in a minute. That sounds fun. But tell me about this cop that took the stand for the defense.
Yeah, his name is Jermaine Hopkins, and he is actually a police officer that I had been critical of in the past. He had done something that I disagreed with, and so I called him out publicly for it. But when he got disciplined, I also acknowledged the fact that in Austin, it seems that the only people who get disciplined are, you know, police officers that they view are expendable, and they very rarely go after police officers who commit really offensive crimes. And so I also, like, reached out to him and said, hey, I recognize the pattern as well. And lo and behold, I guess as he was fighting with the police department over an EEOC complaint, he just started to dive deeper and deeper into my situation, and he realized that I really had been screwed over by the Austin Police Department, and he decided to step forward out of concern for my civil rights. And the day that he told his supervisor that he was going to testify at my trial, the day after, actually, he was terminated. So today is actually technically his last day on the police force.
Wow. And now they got to have rules about stuff like that. Is this in direct violation of them or not? Do you know?
Oh, yeah, it is. And he has I think he has an amazing suit against the city, because they have done numerous things that have been illegal with regards to, employment, civil service laws. They have not paid him overtime. They actually told him that they weren't going to pay him for the time that he was at the courthouse, for my trial. So, he has a real good case against them. They've been bullying him just like they've been bullying a lot of other people. And what they do is they just try to find where their strength is and how they can try to tighten the screws on people. And for people who are not within the system, they do it through trying to get us on criminal acts that we didn't commit. And for people within the system, they go ahead and play political games.
Yeah. Man, I think this is such an important story. This absolutely ought to be national news here. There are so many aspects to this that are, maddening, but also just interesting. You know what I mean? For example, the way, as you say, all the cops and prosecutors showing up to participate in this thing for a Class C misdemeanor. That alone means that there ought to be a Newsweek article about it. There ought to be a 2020 episode about it. What the hell is going on down in Austin, Texas?
I think Austin, Texas is a very unique city. It's very vibrant. It has an amazing array of talented people flowing into the city at all times. The economy is extremely strong. There's all kinds of alternative lifestyles are embraced here. And so in a lot of ways, Austin is seen as this, like, wonderful, new age or progressive, economically vibrant city that everyone wants to be a part of. But then once you're in town, you realize that there's a very, very old, established, good old boys network. And it's very backwards in a lot of ways with regards to the establishment. And the police have a situation where they have a lot of money to play with, and they're in a very safe city, the safest big city in the entire country, with a very unique demographic mix. All the blacks and Hispanics are pushed out to the edges of the city. And the police basically have free rein because almost everyone here has come to the city from elsewhere. There's very few people who are really invested in the workings of the city, so it's all run by the establishment, and they're able to basically get away with whatever they want.
Yeah. Well, you hit on a lot of true things there, man. I wouldn't know where to begin. All right, let's go back. We still got 3 minutes here. Let's talk about some of these bogus charges. They tried to charge you with endangering a child, with racketeering. What in the world?
Yeah, they're just desperate. They've had a task force that's been dedicated towards me. We've seen some of their internal memos. They have celebrity personnel who they have to be concerned about when they arrest and, like, how they address the media. And so they have one section which is UT athletes, one section which are professional football players and basketball players. They have one section which are politicians. And then I'm the only one with a section that's named by name. Like, there's a section for Antonio Beeler, and under Antonio Beeler there are 24 cases, whereas no other section had more than maybe 8-10. They've had senior officers who've been dedicated to me. They've been monitoring everything from me, my location, my online presence, my statements, every single YouTube video that I put out, and one of the things that they've been doing is they've been trying to find ways to get to arrest me. So I posted a satirical post. Everyone who read it knew it was satirical. It was obviously satire. And so they went ahead and they tried to have me arrested or indicted on a felony online impersonation charge, which was absurd. The racketeering charge, if you recall, we gave out 100 video cameras to people at our first summit so people could go record the police. They claimed that I bought cameras and gave them to people so that they can go out and commit crimes by interfering with police officers during investigations. They tried to get me on racketeering. They're desperate.
Now,
they're desperate.
How far did that argument go in court before the judge said, get the hell out of here?
Yeah, fortunately, none of them actually were indicted. Every single one, I think the DA was smart enough to say, we don't really want to be stuck with this.
But the cops keep coming to him with this stuff.
And they were able to get me on misdemeanors. That's sort of the compromise.
All right, peacefulstreets.com is the website. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
All right, take care.